This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on April 20th, 2017. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
With that, let's begin with the Socialist Worker Party issue. And let me introduce some people who are here on behalf of the party. And first would be Allison Kennedy, who is the presidential candidate for the party. And then John Studer, who's a member of the party. And Steve Clark. And then Lindsay Frank, who's the counsel for the party here today. And welcome. It's nice to have you here. We've had a number of times since I've been here where we've been confronted with this issue. Unfortunately, I haven't voted the way you would have liked me to, as you know that, but I'm anxious to learn your views on this. I think it's going to be a good session, and so I look forward to that. The way we are is that anybody, we can ask questions and have someone come up to answer them, or if you'd like to sit at the table now, we could ask questions in a more comfortable setting, and I have a hunch that maybe we'll have a number of questions. So, perhaps we could begin with counsel discussing the issues from the perspective of the two drafts that are maybe the latest, and that's B and C, and talk about the pros and cons of each as they're expressed in those two documents. It can be a short one, but to get kind of introductory discussion on that. Sure.
Thank you, Chairman Walther. Good morning, commissioners. Good morning to all the representatives of the Socialist Workers Party. Agenda documents 1701A, 1701B, and 1701C are alternative draft responses to an advisory opinion request submitted by the Socialist Workers Party, the Socialist Workers Campaign Committee, and committees supporting candidates of the Socialist Workers Party. Socialist Workers Party was granted an exemption from certain disclosure obligations in a 1979 consent decree due to the likelihood that supporters of the Socialist Workers Party would face governmental and private threats, harassment, or reprisals if their connections to the Socialist Workers Party were publicly disclosed. The partial exemption was extended by an updated settlement agreement in 1985 and further extended through advisory opinions issued in 1990, 1996, 2002, 2008, and 2012. The 2012 advisory opinion extended the partial exemption through the end of 2016, and the Socialist Workers Party now asks for the exemption to be extended again. Drafts A and B conclude that Socialist Workers Party has not demonstrated a reasonable probability that disclosing its supporters and vendors continues to subject those persons to threats, harassments, or reprisals. Drafts A and B, therefore, conclude that the partial reporting exemption should not be renewed. Draft C concludes that based on Socialist Workers Party's status as a minor party and the long history of harassment of the party and its supporters, as well as evidence of harassment since the commission last considered the reporting exemption, the partial reporting exemption should be renewed through December 31st, 2020. We received two comments from the requester addressing all three drafts, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any comments from the commissioners to begin with? Would someone like to lead off from the Socialist Workers with a brief discussion of the issues that you think are the most important to lead off with?
Certainly. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, commissioners. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to address this important issue. I believe all of our comments are included in...
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Are you Mr. Frank?
Yes. I believe all of our comments are included in the written comments we've submitted to the commission previously, but I'll give you a general summary of the highlights. The under established Supreme Court and the commission's own precedent, there's an important balancing test at issue whenever an encroachment on important First Amendment rights to privacy of belief and association are involved. And disclosure can only be granted if there's a sufficiently important government interest involved that is substantially related to the disclosure that allows for the encroachment of these important First Amendment rights. Our position is that, given the facts presented here, the long history of the Socialist Workers Party running presidential and vice presidential candidates from over 70 years, as well as candidates in other state and federal elections, and never winning any of those elections. The amounts of money involved within the last four-year period, talking about $82,000, a little over $82,000 in contributions, the vote totals in the 2016 election of just over 12,000 votes in the presidential election, the long history of a complete absence of any indication of corruption or voter diversion, the established and well-known principles of the Socialist Workers Party that are unique and distinct from the positions of any other mainstream party or candidate, as well as several other factors. Given all these factors, there's simply not a sufficiently important governmental interest at issue here, and certainly none that's been identified in either drafts A or B to outweigh the important First Amendment rights involved as well. The First Amendment rights are the First Amendment rights need breathing space to live and to thrive in our democracy, and we need to provide protection for them wherever we can. In the face of the government possesses in the incredible power to subtly and in seemingly facially neutral ways repress dissent, and so I think we all need to be very careful in looking at seemingly facially neutral, innocuous disclosure requirements, and to look at the real impact that it may have on the diversity of opinions that exist, particularly for minor political parties such as the Socialist Workers Party. So given the what we view as the failure to establish any sufficiently important governmental interest or one that has a substantial relation to the disclosure requirements involved here, there's simply not enough evidence to require disclosure here. An exemption should be granted. Under the Commission and Supreme Court's precedent, there's a balancing test, as the commissioners well know, which the governmental interest is balanced against both past instances of threats, harassment, and reprisals, as well as current instances of threats, harassment, and reprisals, to see whether or not those threats outweigh the governmental interest, because the governmental interest is nil or almost nil. Clearly, the long history of threats, harassments, and reprisals that the SWP and its contributors have experienced is more than sufficient to satisfy the requirements of the Supreme Court and the Commission's own precedent. This long history has been recognized by the Commission repeatedly, and it covers not only the period from 1941 to 1976, which is well documented and recognized by the Commission, but also the period from 1976 through 2012, where even drafts A and B recognize that there has been evidence of serious and widespread threats, harassment, and reprisals. Under the Supreme Court precedent of Buckley v. Vallejo, evidence of past or present threats, harassment, and reprisal are sufficient. So evidence of past threats, harassments, or reprisals would be sufficient alone. Nonetheless, the SWP has provided strong evidence of continued threats, harassment, and reprisals of its supporters. In sum, we believe that with these important First Amendment rights, breathing space has to be allowed, and not granting exemption here would send a dangerous, would upset a Supreme Court precedent and would send a dangerous message to other people who support minor political parties and candidates and positions that are outside the mainstream. And so with that, I hope that exemption is granted.
And thank you very much. Comments from Commissioner Goodman.
Mr. Trink, you talked about the history of the Socialist Workers Party facing threats, harassment, stigmatization. Let me. Are you familiar with a 1940s, 50s era economist named Paul Sweezy?
No, I'm not.
Are any of your members familiar with Paul Sweezy? He founded the publication Monthly Review. No, that's. Are you familiar with the history of what happened to Paul Sweezy in the 1950s at all? No? He was a Marxist economist who never supported the overthrow of his government. And yet he was hailed into investigation by the Attorney General of New Hampshire under the theory that he might present a threat of subversion to the United States government. And there was a Supreme Court decision in 1957 called Sweezy v. New Hampshire. Does that ring a bell to any of you? He was jailed because he wouldn't name the names of the founders of the Progressive Party of New Hampshire. You might have caught a movie called Trumbo a couple years ago about Dalton Trumbo, who was one of the Hollywood Ten. He was imprisoned for refusing to name the names of other members of the Communist Party before Congress. He went to prison. He lost his First Amendment appeal in the late 1940s, and the U.S. Supreme Court would not grant certiorari in his case. And that left many people in the socialist and Marxist and communist movement in the United States vulnerable, it seems, to these continuing subpoenas and investigations into what threat they might pose to the United States government. Subsequent to that, many socialists and Marxists faced a dilemma. Since the Supreme Court would not protect their First Amendment rights and of associational privacy, some resorted to invoking their Fifth Amendment rights so they didn't have to name the names of the fellow members of communist and Marxist organizations in the United States. And that brought us to 1954, when Paul Sweezy, who taught at the University of New Hampshire, and by the way, he had served the country in the United States Army in World War II. He had served in the Roosevelt administration. And his goal was to take New Deal economics to the next level of implementation. And he was deemed, because he was a Marxist economist, he was deemed dangerous to the United States. And so when he would not name the names of the other members of the Progressive Party of New Hampshire, he was arrested, and then he appealed, first to the New Hampshire Supreme Court, where he lost, and then to the United States Supreme Court, where he once again asserted the First Amendment right that Dalton Trumbo and other members of the Hollywood Ten would not have recognized. In 1957, on a day called Red Monday, the Supreme Court issued four Supreme Court decisions that people claimed would ruin our democracy and expose it to foreign threats. I think we've heard that more recently as well. One of the cases it decided was Sweezy v. New Hampshire, where six justices dismissed the contempt findings against Paul Sweezy. And the relevant decision for purposes of today was a concurring opinion by Justice Frankfurter joined by Justice Harlan. in which he recognized the First Amendment right of associational privacy, and that we cannot associate and think freely, and we cannot think freely and share ideas freely if we cannot associate freely. And therefore, there was a realm of privacy around which Paul Sweezy and other members of the Progressive Party of New Hampshire had a right to associate without having to name the names. Now, some people believe that's a historical relic of the Red Scare, the second Red Scare in America, and that we are more enlightened today. I might add that concurring opinion of two justices in Sweezy v. New Hampshire became the majority position of the court a year later in 1958 in NAACP versus Alabama. And I'm sure you're well aware of that line of cases and why southern jurisdictions were requiring the NAACP to name the names of their members and supporters before they could get a license to march. Now, some people believe we are more enlightened today, that no one who would join a socialist or Marxist-leaning organization in the United States would ever be threatened again with subpoena. You mentioned seemingly facial and neutral laws, that we're far more tolerant today than we were in the 1940s and 50s. And because of that enlightenment, we no longer need to protect the names of members of organizations such as yours. So I'm asking you, are we that more enlightened? Are your people safe? Do people freely join your organization? Or are they concerned about the stigma and the threats and reprisals that could come from joining your organization? Can you address that?
I believe we've addressed at least some of those issues in the submissions that we presented to the commission. The experience of the SWP in the last 4 years and the last 8 years and beyond has been that there remains significant fear within individuals who are interested in the SWP and its ideas, interested in contributing to the SWP, a fear that associating with the SWP will subject them to some sort of harassment, reprisal, whether it be related to their work or within their community or otherwise. So I think the answer to that question would be yes, there continues to be a significant and reasonable fear within the community of potential supporters that having information publicly disclosed about contributions to the SWP would subject them to harassment, reprisals, or other incidents. I would note that the world that we live in today is significantly different than the world of the 1950s, the 1960s, or the 1970s and early 80s when the important Supreme Court decisions were issued on this issue, Buckley v. Vallejo and Brown versus Socialist Campaign 1974 Committee, when disclosure meant disclosing the names of contributors and expenditures at the office of the FEC. Someone would have to come here and look at the files in order to find out that information. Nowadays, contributions are readily available on the internet, and in fact, there are various different websites that encourage people to look up information about their neighbors, about potential employees, and that's a regular practice both within corporate America and non-corporate America. So I think there's a fear out there, and that fear is reasonable. And it plays very much into the reasonableness of the probability of threats, harassment, and reprisal, which is part of the Supreme Court analysis.
I'd like to ask you to address the issue that I think it comes up in this discussion, and I know it's come up recently, and that is we get it on the history. So I do fully understand that from day one. And clear back to my college days in the early 60s, I majored in Russian. I studied all about everything that was available to read at the time, and I get it. But as time comes on, then things change, and we need to look as we go forward. And over the period of time, it seems to me there's been, and this is just an impression, that the history that once was subject to fear really has ebbed to the point where it has to kind of fit in with the fears that everybody has about some other parties that are out here. And I look at it from the perspective of, and the most recent example, and I know you're aware of that, is Bernie Sanders, who has had a socialist bent, been part of the Socialist Party, not necessarily the Socialist Workers Party. And I'm wondering, that quickly and easily went into the electorate without any major concern about what that word meant. And it seemed to me that, you know, of course, he's had millions of contributions and very popular in terms of obtaining votes. But are there aspects or elements of the socialist theory that is espoused by someone like Senator Sanders versus the Socialist Workers Party? And what are the differences, assuming that the differences are the ones that cause the fear in the people who might be donors?
Yes, I think the differences we have identified in our written comments. One of the principal tenets of the Socialist Workers Party is the abolition of the capitalist system and the establishment of a workers' government without involvement of capitalist principles. The promotion and the recognition of the Cuban Revolution and the potential benefits that such an example could provide for workers in the United States. These are principles that are fundamentally different than the principles espoused by Bernie Sanders. I would assume that they're significantly different than the principles espoused by the individuals who responded to the polls cited in articles in drafts A and B, where people self-identified as socialists. It seems unclear at best and unlikely that those individuals were supporting the principles involved with the SWP. And the matter before the commission now is to look at the principles involved with the SWP, which we believe are significantly different, completely contrary to Bernie Sanders' ideology, which is for free health care. To look, you know, at best, he may describe himself as a democratic socialist, but even, you know, at times hedged on that. If pressed, he would cite the examples of Scandinavian countries that provided free higher education and health care and other benefits, which are not at all the kinds of policy, the principal foundation and the principles of the SWP. So I think therein lies the significant difference. I think one of the underlying ideas of reference to the Senator Sanders and his campaign and the general, the presumed general acceptance of the concept of socialism is that now it's not as vilified a term. But if that were the case, and the SWP and its contributors were no longer subject to, you know, if there was a parallel between those two concepts, one would have expected to see contributions and vote totals of the SWP and its candidates rise significantly as Bernie Sanders and his campaign succeeded. He was able to raise tens and hundreds of millions of dollars and receive millions of votes. The SWP maintains this relatively the same vote totals that it historically has, and indeed below some historic vote totals. So clearly there's a disjunct within the minds of the population between what's going on with Senator Sanders and what's at stake in the case at hand.
Thank you. And you're right, I see that. And I also feel that while we're not there, there is a gravitation of acceptance in our electorate to consider issues such as universal health care or universal, and whatever you call it, and universal, at least education to some level. Those seem to be ones that are more accepting, and at the same time, my impression is that the Socialist Worker Party has advanced slowly, as it may be, in the election, or to the point where you actually had some people who were delegates in a couple of states and were getting there. So when you consider that, we're supposed to mostly look at the prism of, say, the last 4 years. And when I see that, I question whether or not the change in gravitation is such that it still justifies a disclosure of who the donors are. I recognize there hasn't been a lot of money received, and that's a legitimate question. I've only received $80,000 or $86,000, and whether or not they're and that was anonymously, so I assume I don't know what it would be if somebody had to actually disclose their name. But to me, disclosure is important. I'm going to ask you this too: in the Socialist Workers Party, is that a tenet that there should never be a disclosure of campaign finance, regardless of harassment, or is it something? Is it something to work toward? To the point where someday we can do that, or is it something where in its basic tenet would not accept the concept of disclosure of donors in a different day?
I don't know if the Socialist Workers Party as a party has a tenet, has a position on that issue. I would recognize that Supreme Court precedent is quite clear that, you know, for minor political parties, the standard is different than for other parties. And so, and the idea behind that, as the Commission well knows, is to try to maintain the free flow of an exchange of different views within our society. And minor political parties represent a unique position under Supreme Court precedent. And the idea of exemption is to maintain those different and unorthodox or ideas that are outside the mainstream, and that's the purpose of the exemption. Here, the principal issue that I see, that we see here, is that there's just really no it hasn't been explained well, or we don't see any sufficiently important government interest involved in disclosing who the $82,000 who contributed the $82,000, and the risk is that fewer people support a party that has views outside the mainstream. And it's not only the SWP. If exemption's not granted here, there will be a chilling effect on other minor parties, because quite frankly, if exemption's not granted on these facts, it's hard to imagine how a party could qualify for exemption in the future, given the extensive history, including up until 2012, of threats, harassment, and reprisals, the very low vote totals, the very low amount of contributions, the fact that in no state in which the SWP ran a candidate was the difference between the two major party candidates anywhere close to the vote total that the SWP candidate received. So there hasn't been a clearly articulated government interest involved here, and clearly not one with a substantial relationship to the disclosure requirement. And so for that reason alone, we strongly believe that exemption should be granted.
Okay. Thanks. Well, I'm going to turn it over to anybody else who'd like to ask questions at this point. Thank you. Are there any other? Yes, Commissioner Goodman.
I suppose that one of the points that the chairman was getting at was, as your ideas get absorbed into the Democratic Party, or perhaps the Republican Party, but as ideas get absorbed and you become less marginalized intellectually, that somehow you may lose your need for this exemption. I think that was the point being made. I wonder if you could perhaps observe the intellectual history of how your ideas have germinated, the obstacles you've faced in promoting your ideas, and how many decades it has taken you to move some of your ideas into the Democratic Party mainstream through a vehicle like the candidacy of Bernie Sanders or others. And I say this having represented a marginal candidate from the libertarian side who decided that he was better off trying to move his ideas and ideology through the vessel of the Republican Party. That was Ron Paul, who decided he would be better off moving from a marginalized party into the mainstream. So could you discuss that and give us some observation of what happens to the ideas and your ability to germinate and build ideas and push them into the mainstream if your free speech is chilled through stigmatization, harassment, deterrence?
Well, I guess my principal comment is that the SWP really does represent a unique and distinct point of view that is unlike the views of the Libertarian Party or other potential minor parties, political parties that have crossed over into or work collaboratively or introduce their ideas into mainstream politics. The SWP has existed for over 75 years and has always represented and continues to represent really quite a truly unique and distinct viewpoint. It's speculation to say what would happen if the concepts of the abolition of capitalism and the establishment of a workers' government were to be injected into mainstream politics. And when we get to that point, I would be able to discuss that more coherently and more cogently, but I think we're very far away from that point, so it's hard to...
So your point is you haven't been able to make the dent yet?
Yeah.
Okay.
Any further questions? I let's go back to Bernie Sanders, though, but wasn't one of the main tenets of, and I consider areas of strong support... And I've never talked to anybody from the campaign about any of this, but the very fact that the complaint was it's the 1% that rule, that control our country, it's the 1% that have the power. We've got to get rid of the 1%. We've got to level off the amount of income and the and share the wealth. And doesn't attendance like that lend support to your concept, whether it's exactly yours or not? But it seemed to me, even in our country, there's increased issue about unsuccessful recently as well about the sharing of the wealth.
I would venture a guess to say that equality, and I know that equality is a major issue of Socialist Workers Party, as it is with many, many parties. How we get to income equality is a different issue, and I think that's where you see the fundamental differences between a candidate like Bernie Sanders, who is a sitting senator in government, and who would clearly has proposed to work within the constraints of the current economic system to try to redistribute wealth. There's a difference between those positions, the procedures and approach of how to get to income equality, and the approaches of the SWP, which are significantly different. The SWP envisions a different world, a world where there's equality, where there's income equality, but perhaps achieving it through different means. And so therein lies the difference.
Well, could you elaborate on how there would be achieving it through different means than what I perceive to be what you're talking about now, and is through the democratic system that's currently in place? Is there an effort or a desire to get there by some other means?
Well, the Steve Clark. These questions were litigated in federal court in the federal case that all of you have in front of you. The Socialist Workers Party as a Marxist party with a revolutionary perspective has the constitutional rights and liberties to present our views and campaign under the U.S. Constitution. As our attorney said, our Constitution, which is a public document, calls for the overthrow of the capitalist system, the establishment of a workers' and farmers' government, and joining in the worldwide struggle for socialism. We see the Cuban Revolution as one of the key examples of what needs to be done by working people in this country and around the world. That is not the view of Bernie Sanders by any stretch of any imagination.
I would just emphasize that I'm not quite sure where this line of questioning goes, in the sense that it still doesn't address the fundamental issue, which is what is the sufficiently important government interest at issue here, given the facts of the SWP? How does the relationship between Bernie Sanders' campaign and the ideology of the SWP increase the government's interest, given the facts at hand here, given the fact that the SWP's vote totals have not and contributions have not increased above historic levels, and in fact are below historic levels? I understand there's an attempt to try to connect the two, the Bernie Sanders movement with the SWP, but apparently within the population, that connection is not made. Maybe it will be made in the future, but given the facts presented here, there does not appear to be any connection between those two.
I really was trying to draw out the difference that you referred to, the distinction between either it's Bernie Sanders or the democratic system that we presently have in place, and how you want to get to a different democratic system or a different system that's not as democratic, and whether the means is, I think, I see your publication is called The Militant, suggests that it might be something more than just an exchange of ideas. And so I just was trying to discuss that with you. I noticed that in let's put it this way. I guess one of the ways that I'd like to look at it is, what is it that is causing, in your mind, the harassment and the, I'm not aware of any personal injury that was identified, but the fear of retaliation or reprisal. What is it that you think people are fearing?
I think there are several issues involved. First and foremost is the long history of threats, harassment, and reprisal that the SWP has experienced by both government actors and private actors. It's continued uninterrupted for over 70 years. This is a history that's well known and includes and continues to be reported on in mainstream publications, including the New York Times and Washington Post, which continue to uncover articles and information about government surveillance and infiltration of the SWP and equating it to monitoring and surveillance that is documented today of other groups that advocate, that engage in activism that the SWP, that's also involved in SWP activities. So you have a well-known long history. It's connected in the mainstream media to current well-known incidents of monitoring of protest groups at events and involving movements that the SWP is involved in, such as advocacy for immigrant rights, advocacy for the rights of the Muslim community, the Black Lives Matter community, and other protest movements. In addition, you have well-known documented evidence through the Snowden revelations of government surveillance generally. And then you have the introduction of the Internet, which, as I discussed before, makes these disclosure requirements that much more magnified, the potential implications of these disclosure requirements that much more magnified. So you have individuals who, if they give money to the SWP, potentially being exposed to negative consequences within their community in a way that they weren't 20, 30 years ago before the Internet. So for all those reasons and others, you see the fear within some of the potential supporters of the SWP, as was presented in the documents submitted.
Let me ask you this in terms of the surveillance issue. I didn't see anything that suggested there was any surveillance other than a list of some ones that were listed, I guess, a few years back, but wasn't a social workers. So do people, my impression is, get this sense from the days of old, but the days of the last 4 years, there seems to be a paucity of information that would relate to surveillance over Socialist Workers' Party or organized government harassment. Not to say there can't be episodes of clearly inappropriate police conduct. We see that all the time. And it's not necessarily directed toward a party, but it just happens because people are in tough circumstances and tough things happen. But I'm unaware of anything where there's any kind of an organized effort on the part of either the government or the police to inhibit the activities of the Socialist Workers' Parties in the last 4 years at least. The only one that I can recall from the list that you gave was when there was a turmoil outside of an apartment building and there was a complaint and the police came and the police actually said you can go ahead and do it. That was the only time I can remember a brush up with the police, except for maybe the incident where there was a vice president who was stopped both coming and going to Australia but never inhibited in terms of movement. As far as I know, there was a loss of a cell phone, but there's nothing in the information to suggest that there was any connection between the loss of that cell phone and the Socialist Workers' Party or was motivated by it. So in the documents that we have before us, it seems to me pretty thin that there's a current fear that's based upon current events and that's sufficiently prevalent to justify a different treatment than, you know, other political parties.
Well, I guess I would respond to that in a couple of ways. First is that even though some of the reports that have been publicized to date haven't included of government surveillance monitoring of protest groups, haven't included specific information or documents relating to the SWP, that doesn't mean that they don't exist or that the SWP is not being monitored or surveilled. As the Commission well knows and has included in our submission, evidence of COINTELPRO and prior government surveillance and infiltration was only recognized after 13 years of litigation in the federal courts. And in fact, the government had initially denied involvement in certain burglaries, and it was only after extensive discovery. This is litigation discovery that minor political parties and others can scarcely afford with resources of $82,000 a year in political contributions, I'm sure, as you can well imagine. So merely because the reports, the publicly available reports, don't include evidence of specific SWP harassment, that doesn't, or monitoring, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And in fact, I think the evidence that does exist of surveillance of the same types of communities and activities that the SWP supports and engages in, activities and activism that the SWP engages in, is a strong circumstantial evidence that same type of government monitoring continues to this day. Accepting this kind of circumstantial evidence is consistent with the Supreme Court admonition that the evidentiary bar for exemption requests below, and that the commission and the courts be flexible in receiving different forms of evidence to satisfy the requirements of the Supreme Court and this commission. Within the last 4 years. In addition, there were two incidents presented to the commission of police interruption. In addition to 9 documented incidents of prison officials improperly seizing and censoring issues of the militant that were supposed to be delivered to prisoners who were interested in receiving information about the SWP and its beliefs. This is a strong indication that government animosity directed towards the SWP continues to exist. The militant was reporting on news of the day that was broadly reported by other mainstream media, such as the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and yet the militant was the only paper to be singled out, to our knowledge. It was only through the intervention of attorneys that these papers, in some cases, have been released, and in other cases, appeals remain pending, including in Attica, where the appeal remains pending outside of the regulatory period in which the appeal board has to respond. So we continue to see evidence of government harassment in addition to private harassment. The incident that you referred to with the cell phone was a burglary into a SWP candidate's home in which only selected personal political files were scattered or affected by the burglary, and whereas we don't know exactly what the intention was of the burglar, this is again strong circumstantial evidence that this was an outspoken SWP candidate, and so the strong circumstantial evidence is that this was intended and directed towards the SWP. This is in addition to, you know, other evidence provided in the SWP's submission. And the last point I would just make is that even though the number of police interactions may have decreased in this four-year period compared to other periods in which the SWP has requested exemption, the SWP has changed its campaigning techniques, as noted in our submission, in this presidential cycle, and has gone door-to-door as opposed to sitting at public tables. It was principally during the public table distributions and advocacy in the prior periods where the SWP would experience police harassment, and in fact continues to experience police harassment when it does engage in tabling. But because of the change in tactics, that has partially been reflected in the types of incidents that are presented in the current submission.
Thank you. Commissioner, Madam Vice Chair.
Yes, hi. Good morning. Thank you for coming. I think part of what we're hearing and reading is that there's obviously different lines of Supreme Court cases, some that call for disclosure, and that's one that people talk about a lot. There's a lot of news reports now, and it's hard to be against disclosure, especially now, but there's obviously another line that we're talking about here today that says, despite the overarching interest in disclosure, there's a line of cases that the Supreme Court has recognized that certain groups don't need to disclose, which is what we're talking about. And you've received that protection both in federal court and here on a number of occasions. I would not want to be a contributor to the Socialist Workers Party living in Little Havana. And I also wouldn't want to be a contributor to the Tea Party living in San Francisco. I mean, it's truth that there are evidences of harassment that come up in all different facets. You said earlier that if not us, then who? And you said that if you don't get the exemption, that it probably would chill other groups as well. And I wondered if you would talk about that. In addition, whether or not Bernie Sanders all of a sudden decides the Cuban Revolution was a good thing, which I don't anticipate happening, but even if he does do that, that's, to me, irrelevant with respect to the legal analysis. The legal analysis is whether or not the group is a minor party. And that the reason for that is if it's a minor party, if it's not the Republican Party or the Democrat, or as some like to say, the Democratic Party, if it's not one of those two parties, that's the name of it. Okay, that's why they like to say it. If it's not one of the two major parties, then there's not that safety in numbers. There's not that, you know, group, you know, ability to associate with other people and not have your views be so radical. I mean, in a lot of ways, the views of a lot of different groups on the spectrum on either side are radical. They're not mainstream. They're minor parties, which is why you get the exemption. I for one, don't want to delve too deeply into what level of harassment we're talking about. I think, you know, any level of harassment, you know, to an extent is harassment enough. And as you said, the courts have said, you know, look at it and weigh more in the line of accepting the harassment as a problem because the government interest in disclosure for these minor parties is diminished. And that's just what the case law says. So I wonder if you could talk for a minute about other groups. One part of your comment on page 4 of your most recent comment on April 16th, the last full paragraph before the bullet, you say SWP has presented evidence of both past and present threats, harassment and reprisals against SWP supporters, a record long recognized as unmatched by any other applicant for exemption. And it is true that I think you're the only one that has a current exemption before the FEC, but my understanding is you're not arguing that you should be the only one either.
That's correct. We don't argue that we should be the only one capable of receiving exemption. Quite the contrary. We fully support the position you very eloquently articulated, which is that there's a line of Supreme Court cases that clearly holds that parties that can establish that they're minor political parties are entitled to special protections of the important First Amendment rights of them and their supporters. And the purpose behind that is to maintain a very a diverse range of ideas that float around in our society, and to recognize the precarious situation that minor political parties that don't have the financial and the popular support of mainstream parties has, the precarious situation that they have. So if a party can qualify as a minor political party, they should be able to, and they can show that the reasonable probability of threats, harassment, and reprisals outweighs whatever the substantially important government interest government interest that's substantially related to disclosure. If it can outweigh that, then it's entitled to exemption. And that analysis has to be done, as you, I think, quite rightfully point out, on the basis of the facts presented. And here, our position is the facts presented quite clearly show that the government interest is nil or almost nil and that weighs against this very long history of threats, harassment, and reprisals and evidence of current. And so when you balance, there's just no question that the past and present threats, harassment, and reprisals outweigh the current government interest in disclosure.
Thank you.
Anything further? Commissioner Weintraub, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for all four of you coming and for all the effort that you've put into this. We've been here before. I've been here before. I have, I think, twice voted to grant this exemption. I have done that despite the fact that I'm a strong believer in the really important principles of disclosure that underlie the campaign finance laws and that have been upheld robustly by the Supreme Court by an 8-1 margin, and one of the few things that the court almost unanimously actually agrees on in this area. We don't get 5-4 decisions on disclosure. Last time it was an 8-1, because it's important to the electorate to have that information. And there are, frankly, a lot of people who would rather not give us that information, and a lot of people who make the argument that, you know, we don't want to tell anybody who we're supporting because we think we're going to get harassed. So it's a principle that could become elastic and undermine the law at large. Now, the courts have recognized that minor parties are in an unusual situation, but they have not gone so far as to say minor parties don't have any disclosure obligations, and they've not gone so far even in granting the Socialist Worker Party's exemption to saying it's permanent. You know, we've seen this long and serious history, and therefore we're giving you a permanent exemption from disclosure. That's not what they did. And that's why you have to come back every 4 or so years and ask for it to be renewed. And the fact that you have to come back every 4 years and ask for it to be renewed, I think, demonstrates that you need to continually demonstrate that it's not just a historical artifact, that however bad things were in the 40s or the 50s or the 70s, that you continue to have a legitimate concern about harassment. I went back and reread the Thurgood Marshall's opinion in Brown v. Socialist Workers, and what he said there was that at that time, appellees introduced proof of specific incidents of private and government hostility toward the SWP and its members within the 4 years preceding the trial. These incidents included threatening phone calls and hate mail, the burning of SWP literature, the destruction of SWP members' property, police harassment of a party candidate, and the firing of shots at an SWP office. There was evidence of firings. There was history of FBI surveillance, a program including disclosing to the press the criminal records of SWP candidates and sending anonymous letters to members, supporters, spouses, and employers. So there was a serious history there of bona fide harassment, and people had legitimate concerns about it. But as I said, you have to come back every 4 years, and I think not just rely on what happened decades ago. And as I look at the evidence that you have presented, and I believe the burden is on you to present evidence that this situation persists, it seems to me that the evidence has gotten weaker and weaker over time. And that's a good thing. That's excellent news, really. But last time, I recall looking at it and saying, it's really not overwhelmingly compelling, but balancing all the concerns, I decided to vote for it last time, but I was really sort of on the fence last time and decided to vote in favor of the exemption. But when I look at the evidence that you've presented in connection with this current request, it seems to me that there just is not very much there that demonstrates an ongoing and current concern over harassment that I think is in a unique case by itself that, you know, all sorts of other donors might not say, hey, you know, I just don't want people to know who I'm supporting politically because it would be unpopular in my neighborhood. You know, you don't have to be a supporter of the SWP in, what did you say, Little Havana?
Little Havana.
You know, you might be a supporter of some other left-wing candidate or cause and feel like you'd be subjected to harassment or, you know, to the contrary, as my colleague indicated. You know, if you live in San Francisco and you support conservative causes or candidates, you might say, well, I just don't want people to know about that because I think I'm going to get grief about that. So I think it has to be more serious than that. Otherwise, the entire disclosure system will crumble. You know, even recognizing the unique history and even recognizing the status of minor party candidates has been the special status that the courts have granted. I think there still has to be some evidence of ongoing harassment. And I'm just not seeing anything that rises to the level of the kind of incidents that Thurgood Marshall was describing when he wrote about this decades ago. So it's, although I've supported this before, it is difficult for me today to say that the exemption is still warranted.
I would just say, I mean, I agree that a regular review of the status is not is a reasonable request, and I think is required and may be required. Certainly, there's not as the Supreme Court held, there's not a per se exemption for minor political parties. But I think at every interval, the balancing test has to occur. And the question, you know, one of the fundamental questions is, what is the interest of the government in disclosure, and balance that against the potential of a minor political party losing much needed support and the ability for it to promote its message within our society. Minor political parties hold a unique status. That's what the Supreme Court precedent held. So it's not the same as a potential supporter of a major party who might say, well, I don't want to contribute because maybe, you know, someone will criticize me because I'm a Republican in San Francisco, or, you know, I'm a socialist in Little Havana, I'm a Democrat in, you know, the heart of Alabama. It's not the same because the Democratic Party and the Republican Party do not have as much at risk as minor political parties. Minor political parties, when you're talking about $82,000 of contributions annually, the potential for fall off is much more significant than when you're talking about the Democratic Party that's able to raise $800 million in contributions. Additionally, you know, even though the number type of incidents of harassment may be different this time than other times, you know, that's in part reflective of the approach that the SWP has taken in terms of its advocacy. It's also, you know, I think I would urge the commission to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, even 25 incidents of harassment compared to the number of contributors to the SWP is a significant percentage. And if you were to proportionally pair that out to the Republican Party or the Democratic Party or the Libertarian Party that has significantly more support, you're talking about thousands, tens of thousands of incidents. So, you know, I would, you know, I would say that, you know, the balancing test can be done and should be done regularly. But we have to, I think, be honest about what's really at stake here and look at the facts presented. And in our estimation, we think that the evidence not only of past but of current threats, harassment, and reprisals is significant and certainly sufficient to support and to satisfy the Supreme Court requirement. Although it's different than the evidence presented in Brown in 1982, Brown was not a basement. You know, it was not the minimum. those were the facts in 1982, and so the facts are different here, but we believe they're sufficient to satisfy the balancing test. And, you know, I would just add as a general comment that, the stakes are increased even more in today's environment, where there's a real polarization within the public dialogue. And you see articles in the New York Times today about demonstrations at Berkeley and other campuses around the country and other locations where individuals with ideas outside the mainstream, whether they be white supremacist groups or fascists, are being, their voice is being quelled because of demonstrations. So you see the potential. You can see how the reasonableness of individuals' fear is magnified in today's environment, and the fear of harassment, I think, plays a significant role within the Supreme Court analysis of whether or not minor political parties can survive in today's environment.
But if I may, Mr. Chairman,
of course,
we're not talking about minor political parties writ large. In fact, you are the only political party that has ever gotten this exemption. So we're just talking about you. And I think that you need to come up with evidence that people are being harassed because of their affiliation with the Socialist Workers Party, not because they're fascists or nationalists or, you know, whatever other group is unpopular today. Those people aren't in front of us asking for an exemption. You're here asking for an exemption. And I don't think you can rely on the fact that people at large are getting harassed out there. Because, as I said, you know, anybody could say the same thing. Any donor could come in here and say, I don't want to, and we have had donors who've come in and said this, you know, that they have looked for ways that some of us have deemed legal and others of us have deemed not so legal to avoid disclosing their names because of the polarized political environment, and people are more hot-tempered about things these days. I think you're in a unique situation, and you have to make a unique showing about your people, not about other people.
That's a point is well taken. I mean, we've just in this last submission to the comments, and of course it's been a short time, but we submitted one additional declaration by Steve Kobach, who's indicated that he's talked to supporters, a supporter. Well, unfortunately, you know, with a minor political party, you know, oftentimes information is not that might not have the infrastructure of a major political party. You know, you may not get information about every potential supporter or current supporter who's withdrawing support or potential supporter who decides not to give support. But we have, at the very least, presented, you know, in response to some of the drafts, filed here, evidence of, you know, one supporter who, based on the current environment, has decided not to support the SWP. And so this, you know, the number of supporters is different within the SWP than for other parties. And that has to be taken, I think the proportionality has to be taken into account as well. So, you know, when you're talking about the Tea Party or you're talking about the Libertarian Party, the number of supporters there and how many people draw is going to be different than when you're talking about 86 individuals who provided contributions above the $200 threshold in the last four-year period, and similar numbers, you know, in the past. You know, one or two or five contributors is significant and is much more significant for minor political parties with these facts than for even other minor political parties, let alone major political parties.
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, Commissioner Peterson, give him a shot.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question of the evidentiary showing that you must make in order to justify the continuing partial exemption from the disclosure requirements, it really does turn on the question of the government's interest. And as you pointed out, when it comes to minor parties, the government, the strength of the government's interest really is a sliding scale. As the financial clout and electoral prospects of a political party and its candidates are greater, then obviously the government's interest in disclosure in those instances similarly increases. The flip side of that is if the financial clout of a minor party is minimal and the electoral prospects of its candidates are negligible, then the government's interest is sufficiently weakened. You've mentioned the numbers of votes and the amount of money that have been raised in the 2016 cycle. I think it's important to put that into context. So 12,000 votes were received by, and I understand all Socialist Worker Party candidates in the 2016 cycle.
That's the presidential, but presidential.
That's the presidential. So 12,000 votes in the presidential.
Yeah.
There were 137 million votes cast in the 2016 presidential race. So we're talking about fractions of 1%. The money that was raised in the 2016 cycle, $82,000, that's in the context of $6.8 billion being spent during the 2016 cycle. So in light of those numbers and in that context, the government's interest, as we mentioned, which is on a sliding scale, in disclosure in this particular instance, is exceedingly attenuated. And so consequently, the evidentiary showing that must be demonstrated by the SWP is similarly not prohibitive. As you mentioned, the relevant court cases in this realm don't require a very high bar. It's a reasonable probability, and again, that analysis has to take place in the context of what is the government's interest, which, as I pointed out, is exceedingly small in this particular case. And what you've demonstrated to us, it may not be overly extensive. And as my colleague Commissioner Weintraub has pointed out, it's a positive trend that the number of incidences and the severity of them has decreased. But that doesn't mean that that's got to be weighed in light of what the strength of the government's interest is in this particular case. And the government's interest just is not weighty in this particular instance. And so I don't view this as requiring reams and reams of evidence in order to justify the ongoing partial exemption from the reporting requirements. And so in light of the fact of the SWP being a minor party, and in light of the numbers, in terms of the votes, in terms of the money raised, the government's interest here may not be nil, but I think it's close to that in this particular case. And it's for that reason that I think that the SWP has demonstrated sufficiently that it warrants the ongoing for another 4 years until the commission reviews it again, an extension of the reporting exemption that you've enjoyed thus far, and so at the appropriate time when we go into motions, I'll be planning to support draft C.
Thank you, Mr. Goodman.
Yeah, I can abbreviate my comments because Commissioner Peterson more eloquently stated some of the points I was going to make. But I didn't understand you to say that because a Trump supporter got punched in Berkeley, you therefore deserve an exemption from this law. I understood you to say that in the context of the polarization of politics today, and in light of decades of history of harassment and stigmatization and marginalization of Marxists and socialists, and given a continuing record that may not be as voluminous as you had 4 years ago, but there is a record, that in light of all that context, the perception and the deterrent effect of joining with you, if names are disclosed, carries a quite reasonable risk that deters your First Amendment rights. And that's the way in which I understood the context that you provided.
Anything further? There's been a conversation in the documents about how small, and it's regenerated now, how small of piece of the pie your organization consists of in the overall electorate. But I think it's important to remember that, and let me go back, and people talk about the government's interest. It's the people's interest. This isn't a government-protected right. It's the right for the people to know about where the money is coming from in an election and make their own decisions about whether or not they want to support the people that are putting money in a particular place. So I think the nomenclature we use should be really it's the people's interest, and it's the government that may be protecting it through litigation and our documents. But to me, all of us who go to the polls want to know really where the money is coming from, and increasingly so. So if you look at any organization, you can look at the Bush-Gore case. There's one county involved. You can look at the state of Nevada, from which I'm from, where there was a senator that ran and won the whole state by 400 votes, give or take 10 or 15 votes. And that particular senator became a majority leader and had a lot to do with the direction of our country and what we did and how we did it. Right or wrong, the point that I'm making is a very small number of votes can make a very big difference, and especially so, I think, now when we have a voice of small people, small numbers of people can have a great reach. And if properly enunciated, sometimes a reach that's never quite anticipated. And we've seen in this own election recently the effect that the electorate can be affected by a small group of people or a relevant or just hitting the right chord. So I don't think we should minimize the importance of what we do here today just because this particular organization is small or that it has a small budget. If you have a strong message, the hell with the budget. And I think we've seen that to a large degree in our recent politics. So I don't think that's a factor that's going to persuade me on that. And I keep and go back to Scalia. I know some people here don't follow his philosophy to the same degree that some of us do. But he did make the point in Doe versus Reed, and I know you're quite aware of it, requiring people to stand up in public for their political acts fosters civic courage, without which democracy is doomed. And I emphasize the word courage. For my part, I do not look forward to a society which, thanks to the Supreme Court, campaigns anonymously, and in the parentheses is McIntyre, and even exercises the direct democracy of initiative and referendum, hidden from the public scrutiny and protected from the accountability of criticism. This does not resemble the home of the brave. I think that is a factor that we always must keep in mind when we make a decision on trying to balance our interest, is the right to know is the most critical part of the election system. That's this only reason we're here, is to provide the electorate with information regarding where the money is going and where it's coming from. And that's what sparked the genesis of this organization, and that's one of our most important things that I think we can't take that lightly. So to me, when we start to balance, those are some of the considerations in my mind.
May comment on that?
Of course. And by the way, I want to compliment you on your briefs. They're really quite well done, your letters.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Regarding the point about where the money comes from, as the Supreme Court cases make quite clear, that is an important consideration for the Commission. But the Supreme Court has articulated three principal interests that the government or the people have in disclosure. One is and the principal concern that all of the Supreme Court cases and many of the district court and circuit court cases have focused on is the weeding out corruption, whether it be quid pro quo corruption or vote diversion, as drafts A and B have cited. In this case, given the facts presented here, neither of those concerns are at issue. There's no potential for quid pro quo corruption because in the 70 years that the SWP has run candidates, it has never won an elected office. Vote diversion is not an issue, because even though there may have been some races decided by a small number of votes, in all of the races, as demonstrated in our submission, in which the SWP ran a candidate, the vote total that the SWP candidate received was nowhere close to flipping that individual race. The closest was a race in which the Democrat won in Minnesota by 40-plus thousand votes, and the SWP candidate received fewer than 2,000 votes. And in fact, there were several other parties that had gained more votes than the SWP candidate. So there's no, and in the 70-plus years that the SWP has run candidates, there's been absolutely no evidence of vote diversion. As the Supreme Court has indicated, the mere possibility or potential for there to be an issue does not justify the significant encroachment on important First Amendment rights. There has to be an articulated, sufficiently important government or public interest, and then a substantial relationship between that interest and the disclosure and the case at hand. And here, based on the identified three public or governmental interests, that just doesn't exist. The two other interests have never been raised in this proceeding, and in fact, the Supreme Court has consistently ruled that there's no interest in the population of knowing what the SWP's positions are, what its policy are, based on contributions, because it's well known and it's readily available and well known in any publication of the SWP or any of its literature, and the reporting requirements are otherwise addressed. Concerning your a citation to Justice Scalia in the Doe case, I would just point out that Doe v. Reed was a case involving referendums, and a significant portion of that decision and Justice Scalia's concurrence was in making a distinction, an exception for participation in the legislative process through referendum. And the Supreme Court has made a distinction between that and the anonymity that has been historically protected for contributors, and that contributors have a different interest involved than individuals signing a legislative referendum.
Anything further? No, Commissioner Weintraub, sorry.
But doesn't that go the wrong way for you? I mean, the court has historically held there's a stronger interest in disclosing the names of donors to candidates and political parties than to people supporting referenda. I agree with your argument, but I think it cuts against you. It's funny, my staff was sending me the same quotes from Doe v. Reed as you were reading them. We're all thinking about the same cases. One of the other comments that Justice Scalia made in Doe v. Reed was the First Amendment doesn't protect you against criticism or even nasty phone calls, which goes back to the point that I was making before, that I think you still need to come up with some evidence of something serious, not just an inchoate fear of harassment, but some actual bad things that are going on and clearly happened historically. I happened to be visiting the African American History Museum yesterday, which I recommend to everybody. So the history of bad acts to suppress political activity by unpopular and disenfranchised people in our society is very present in my mind today. But I think you still need to show some kind of evidence that this is still going on. And it strikes me that, I've looked at what you've presented to us, and it just, there's got to be something there.
I mean, I would just point out, make two comments. One is, we've noted in the comments that both drafts A and B at least appear to impose a requirement that serious incidents of threats, harassment, and reprisal be demonstrated, which I'm not sure if that's what you're getting at, Commissioner Weintraub, but the Supreme Court precedent does not require serious incidents of threats, harassment, and reprisal. In fact, it requires reasonable probability of mere threats, harassment, and reprisals. You may, in various cases and certain concurrences and decisions of the Supreme Court and other courts, have held that evidence of serious threats, harassments, and reprisals has been presented, but it's never been required. And I think that's an important distinction to make because, you know, it may not be that the potential contributor is necessarily going to look at the seriousness of the threats, harassment, and reprisals. It may not seem serious to you, but it may be very serious to that person, or it may be sufficient to, may not be serious, but it's sufficient to prohibit them from contributing or participating within a minor political party such as the SWP. And that's significant, and that's significant in the Supreme Court line of inquiry. And I would just say that, you know, that there's a, I think as Commissioner Peterson accurately pointed out, our position is that there's really a sliding scale here, and that as the government's interest in disclosure increases, for example, if there were to be vote casts in one or more several states in which the SWP candidate could have flipped the election, that potentially does increase the government's interest in disclosure, and that may increase the onus on the minor political party to provide evidence of more or different types of harassment, threats, and reprisals. For example, in the 1982 Brown case, it was noted that the difference in the Ohio election was 14,000 votes. And the SWP candidate received well over 70,000 votes. And yet, based on the evidence of the evidence that you, Commissioner Weintraub, had cited, that was sufficient to overcome the government's interest in that case. And here we have vote totals that are significantly below that. And so there's a, I would argue that there is a sliding scale. I would argue that the Supreme Court precedent requires a sliding scale of evidence that would be sufficient to satisfy the Supreme Court requirement.
I hear what you're saying, and you know, sort of to go back to what Commissioner Peterson was saying, you know, if there is a balancing test to be made, and Commissioner Peterson has made the point that he thinks the governmental interest is fairly light, there's still got to be something on the other side to that's heavier than that. And I think it's got to be something more than hypothetical concerns.
Any further comment, questions? Anything further you'd like to add to this?
No.
Let me just say this has been very, very educational and interesting, and thank you very much for the time and attention you've given it to us. And like I say, I thought the work that was done to present your position was really tops. And again, thanks, and how we come out, we'll discuss, but it won't be without some really fine argument and presentation. Let's go ahead and proceed. Do we have a motion? Yes, Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move approval of agenda document number 17-01-C, otherwise known as Draft C, in the Socialist Workers Party AO, AO 2016-23.
Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. The motion fails. The I voted against. Commissioner Weintraub voted against. In favor was the Vice Chair, Commissioner Goodman, and Commissioner Peterson. Go ahead. Commissioner Weintraub.
Not that this will pass either, but just for completion's sake. with respect to the Social Workers Party advisory opinion request 2016-23, I move approval of agenda document 17-01B, also known as draft B.
Any discussion? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion fails. I voted in favor. Commissioner Weintraub voted in favor, and against was the Vice Chair, Commissioner Peterson, and Commissioner Goodman. Any further matters to take up at this point? If not, thank you very much, sirs. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Aye, ma'am. Let's take a break for 15 minutes.